Welcome back. Hi, it's been a while. My podcast, the Greg Kelly Podcast. It's early December. I feel pretty good personally, physically, family-wise. Everything's great. Mentally, I'm all right. What else is going well? Work, good. The country, terrible. Terrible. And I am very much creeped out by the elections. What happened, given what was happening nationally? That war we lost last year, and Joe Biden and his party performed better than like basically any president ever in a midterm, in a first midterm like that. What, W won in 02, but the losses should have been much, much, much more severe. And I don't know. I think it's the mechanics of voting. I think the Republicans have totally lost that game. And are they ever going to get it back? I don't know. Voting now is more akin to a department store sending out thousands upon thousands upon thousands of mailers, you know, coupons or those little penny savers. That's what ballots are like now, just trash. Just get it to as many humanoids as possible. Somebody fill it out. And that's all that matters. I'm very, very concerned. I don't know what's going to happen. It's in times like these, and in all times, quite frankly, good times and bad, the answer, I find, is with the Lord. And if you have not started that journey, you may want to think about it. I don't want to say, do I urge you to? No, only you can make that decision with his help. But maybe you heard me talk about it before. Someone gave me a Bible 10 years ago. 10 years ago, right about now, actually. And they gave it to me, and I said, what are you, some sort of a church lady? Leave me alone. I'm good. What? 4 years went by before I actually started to read it. And then, wow, all kinds of miracles started to happen. And he, capital H, started talking to me, and everything started to change. I have a long way to go, but I'm off and running, literally. So today in the podcast, I talked to the author of The Oswalds, An Untold Account of Marina and Lee by Paul R. Gregory. So Professor Gregory, he's an academic, but he knew Lee Harvey Oswald and his wife Marina in the a year or so leading up to the assassination. Spent several months meeting with them, talking with them, especially in the summer, I believe, of 1962. Right after the assassination, the Secret Service wanted to talk to him in a big way, and he helped in any way he could. He had no inkling that this was going to happen, but it does make there's a certain logic to it as you look back at it. The book is fascinating. If you're into the Kennedy assassination, or even if you're not, I think it's of great value. Little tidbits that I did not know. Marina Oswald was going to strip clubs at one point in her life and was really in a downward spiral. What else is bizarre and unknown to me up until now in reading this book? The Russians, the Soviets, panicked after the assassination. Of course, Lee Harvey Oswald spent, 2.5, 3 years or so in Russia, and they thought that the world might suspect them of having played a role in the assassination. They didn't. I don't believe they did. But they had a hand in putting out the disinformation that the mafia wanted to kill Kennedy. I did not know that until this book. But what a unique position to be in. You are a college student, and everything is, you know, fine in life. And one day, one of your friends, associates, is accused of killing the president of the United States. It's shocking enough when the president gets killed, and it unfortunately happens every couple of decades or so, it seems, in America, where an attempt is made. But to know the person who tried to take out a president, that's kind of unthinkably shocking. So it's all in the book, An Untold Account of Marina and Lee. The Oswalds is its name. It's available wherever books are sold. I'm holding a copy of it right here, and I wish I could show you the pictures inside. There are some famous pictures, like Lee Harvey Oswald in the backyard with that rifle, the famous one. But there are some others that you may never have seen before, including pictures of them in Minsk, and Paul and his family, and it's just rich stuff. And you know, now more than ever, I do value the peace, tranquility, and I don't know, the overall mentally holistic activity of reading, which is so unnatural these days with that silly smartphone, dumb phone everywhere, all the time. You spend more time on the phone than you do in reality. You know, they say you check the phone 80 times a day. Not really. You check the outside world maybe 80 times a day, but you're mostly on that. And it's no way to live. Anyway, thanks for listening. Before we get to my guest, I have this important message that it's Christmas time again, and that means it's time to think of great gifts for people we care about. And you know what I'm going to be getting this year for other people? Ironwood cutting boards. Yes, these are magnificent. They are made from great-looking, durable, and sustainable acacia wood. Ironwood cutting boards. They are the perfect addition to any home. What's more, every tree that's used to make an awesome ironwood cutting board is immediately replaced by a new one. In fact, ironwood cutting boards are so popular, they are the number one selling cutting board at both Crate and Barrel and Williams-Sonoma. So don't buy an impractical gift that folks will probably return this Christmas or never use or forget about. Buy a beautiful and useful ironwood cutting board at ironwoodgourmet.com. Ironwoodgourmet.com. That's iron, I-R-O-N, of course, wood, W-O-O-D, gourmet, G-O-U-R-M-E-T.com. Ironwoodgourmet.com. Ironwoodgourmet.com. You can also go to Amazon. They're pretty good. And put in the search word ironwood, ironwood cutting board. And it's a fantastic product. I've got about two of them, actually, right here. And they are very solid, durable. I like the way they look as well. We thank Ironwood Gourmet. Check out ironwoodgourmet.com. And now, my conversation with Paul R. Gregory, author of The Oswalds, An Untold Account of Marina and Lee. You know, I just jumped into it, didn't I? Just so everybody knows, Lee Harvey Oswald is the one accused of killing John F. Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. People can disagree with this. It's okay. But I happen to believe that it was Oswald and Oswald by himself. I'm open-minded on the subject, however, but I'm pretty convinced that that is what happened. The Warren Commission is better than people give it credit for being. A lot of people who don't give it much credit haven't even read it. If you sit down and read the thing, you may change your mind. Anyway, now to the conversation. Your present title is what?
Research Fellow, Hoover Institution, Stanford University.
And are you an economist? Or are you associate?
I'm an economic historian, which sort of puts me in both camps. So the research fellow position is definitely a research position. So I'm not doing any teaching. I've not taught since I retired from University of Houston in 2018.
Have you spent your adult life in academia? Have you been a professor and a teacher all of these years?
Yes. I taught starting in 67. I was a teaching assistant at Harvard, where I got my PhD. Then I went back to my undergraduate alma mater, Oklahoma, and I taught there from 69 to 72. Then I taught at the University of Houston from 72 to 2018, which is quite a long period of time. I retired, and I was jointly working at Houston and at Stanford at the same time. So I've been in the research fellow position now for about 12 years, I would say.
By the way, students, I would imagine, changed a lot from 1972 to 2018. Did they? And how so? How did they change?
Well, it's kind of odd the way I'm going to answer. From the teacher's perspective, there was an adjustment process to the smartphone because I was late in getting a smartphone and I didn't quite realize how alluring that is to students. So it was hard to get students' attention once the smartphone came in. That's an odd answer. Over time, it's really hard for me to judge over time. I would say over time, there was less interest in what the lecturer was saying and a lot more interest in what the grade was going to be and how tough the exams were going to be. So, but I don't really see a secular trend in this. Students today are not that much different from students of, say, 1980.
They're not, so like the quality, what about their quality of the papers they submit? Are they on par with where they were 40 years ago?
It's awfully hard. Well, I would say my longest experience was at the University of Houston, and the university itself was improving, and its attractiveness to students was going up. And as a consequence of that, you got more better students being attracted. So that's what I could see. Better students were attracted. But that kind of masks the issue of, say, the average quality of the student.
Yeah. No, I understand. And University of Houston is a very desirable school. And just one more thing on this. Do you think professors, or looking back, did you modify your teaching approach as the smartphone kind of encroached upon their attention span and things like that? Did you attempt to modify, change, you know, alter your own presentation in order to command attention more effectively?
Well, the biggest innovation was the ability to flash to flash information on the screen. I'd been doing that manually, you know, preparing transparencies and then going through and organizing the transparencies. But the minute you could put the image on your computer, that changed things considerably. I would say it led to a deterioration in the quality of instruction, because once you had images 1 through 20, you just flashed the images and then kind of repeated what was on that image. So that's not a very exciting way to teach.
And you spent your whole life in academia. The internet, smartphones, forget about smartphones for a moment. Has the internet helped scholarship? You can access things much more easily, but I would imagine that you could also leave whatever you're reading very easily and be drawn somewhere else. And I wonder about the quality of thought and, I don't know. Like, what, you know what I'm getting at here?
My answer is very easy to give you, because it is in the internet and Google improved my productivity by about 10,000%. And I'll give you an example, because one of my activities was writing textbooks, and I was very successful in writing economics textbooks, but back in 1980, if you wanted to gather information, like what's the growth rate of GDP, what's the inflation rate, when was a certain labor law passed, you had to go walk over to the library and go through an immense amount of work just to get some very basic facts. Now with Google, you can be an expert on virtually any subject within a matter of an hour, because you just Google it pops up, and it's there. This helped me in my other career, which we've not talked about, which is writing op-eds. And it's much easier to write an op-ed now, because you can get all the information you need for that subject out of Google.
Okay, it definitely would enhance your and your ability to access data. You're data driven as an economist. I just want to run this by you. I'm reading a book. It's a bestseller, and I am astounded with how many mistakes that I am encountering. Things that I just know to not be true are there in black and white in the book. And my theory is that this author could sit down and just Google everything, and she's, instead of meeting the people, for instance, it's about Donald Trump and his commute to Fordham University, and they have in black and white. He took a bridge that he never would have taken to Fordham. It's just a bizarre thing. And one story got that wrong 15 years ago, and it gets repeated and repeated and repeated. This author does not have to, would never even think to recreating that route in a car, like maybe somebody like Robert Caro would do or did. So the richness, I think, for a lot of is being lost, and the text that the granular stuff that really made it, again, it's unrelated to your field, but other fields I think are suffering. It's too easy to get information, so you won't go and experience something or understand it at a deeper level. Forgive me for running that by you, but
I think you're correct, but it's also a sign of laziness. For example, if I write an op-ed and it's fortunate to be published in Wall Street Journal, believe me, they challenge every fact. But that's a very expensive operation that only a few, national or international publications can do. So, but it's easy to be lazy. It's easy to pass up the opportunity to check a particular fact or what have you. So. But it's sure changed my life.
When you left the University of Houston in 2018, what was that like? What was your retirement like?
I kept on doing what I'd always done, which is researching and writing. So there wasn't really much of a change other than the fact that my Tuesdays, Thursdays, and sometimes Friday were now free, and I didn't have to be in Houston on each day of class. So it gave me additional freedom to continue to do what I love to do.
Along the way, did you get married? Did you have kids?
Of course, yeah. No, I married Anna Marie, whom I met in Berlin. I had a fellowship there. Unfortunately, I'm now a widower, but I have two sons and four granddaughters, all of whom speak very good Russian and very good Ukrainian. So that's a rather interesting feature of my current life.
That's amazing. Where were you born?
San Angelo, Texas.
And how many siblings did you have?
Three. And San Angelo, Texas was the nearest hospital to the West Texas oil fields, and that's where my father worked.
What did he do there? And I know your father's going to come up later, but what was his job?
Petroleum engineer. When he escaped from Russia, he came to the U.S. and enrolled at Berkeley as a mining engineer. And that's when the West Texas fields were being developed. And he claimed, and I think accurately, that he was the first university-trained petroleum engineer in West Texas.
When you say escape from Russia, can you tell us a little bit about that? And how old was he when he left Russia?
This would have been the Civil War, which began 1918, ended 1921-22. So he would have been like 16 when he left Siberia. He was born in Siberia because of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. So he would have left around 16, 17, couple of years in Tokyo, and then on to California.
When you were growing up in that house with your siblings and your parents, were academics you were encouraged to achieve in school?
Yes, but it was sort of taken for granted that we were middle class or upper middle class with highly educated parents. So it was taken for granted. We were all going to go to the university. In those days, master's degrees and PhD degrees were a little bit unusual. So I'm the only one of my siblings who went on for an advanced degree.
And I'm sorry, you did your undergrad at University of Oklahoma, was it?
Correct.
And by the way, before we go into Oswald Matters, why did you choose economics? Why was that your field of specialty?
Well, it wasn't the result of a great deal of thought. I, like many of my friends, had decided I was going to be a lawyer and would go to University of Texas Law School. And I played tennis with a bunch of lawyers, successful lawyers, and they said, "Well, if you're going to be a lawyer, you should get an undergraduate degree in economics." So it's on the basis of that that I chose economics.
So this book, one thing I noticed is I consider myself above average when it comes to knowledge of the Kennedy case. I'm not an expert, obviously. I've never written about it. I've never been published about it. I've read a fair amount. There's a lot of this book that I had not heard before, that I was just unfamiliar with, that had never occurred to me. And I'm just going to give you one instance, and then we'll take it from the beginning. But I think you said that Robert Oswald took one look at Ruth Payne and didn't like her, and he admonished her from ever returning, Marina, ever returning to her home. And I found that very interesting. I'd never heard it before. Maybe that's all over the place. Maybe Priscilla McMillan or whatever. But how did you know that? And you know what I'm talking about, the details here. How much of this is scholarship and how much of it is, I'm talking, obviously, your experiences with Oswald and your families and all that stuff, that's personal. These other matters, though, where they were, when they were there, conversations like that, how much of this was based on, scholarship and reviewing, the work of others?
That's actually a good question because I think I would not have written the book had I not been able to approach the subject as a scholar. You know, that is going into the archives, going into the records, reading the testimony, et cetera. So if it had only been me, having taken lessons from Marina and knowing, being together with Lee a lot, I probably would have written a short article about it or a long article, and that would have been it. And I'll get to answering your question about Ruth Payne in just a second. The fact that there was so much information, factual information that was out there and which would contribute to my understanding of what was going on, that's what gave me the impetus to write the book. Now, with respect to Robert Oswald and Ruth Payne, that came, I believe, from my father, who was an eyewitness to the events that occurred immediately after the assassination. Robert looked her up and down. She was a Quaker, anti-war type, which was unusual in those days. And he thought she was a hippie and a bad influence and didn't want Marina to have anything more to do with her, which was contrary to what Marina wanted. Marina wanted the familiarity of going back into Ruth Payne's house and living as they had lived. So that's an example. But and don't expect me to remember a lot of things that I've forgotten. I think there's also substantiation in some of the testimony that Robert took one look at Ruth Payne and decided she wasn't for Marina.
So, how did you meet Lee Harvey Oswald?
It would have been, say, mid-June of 1962. He had just returned with Marina and the baby to Fort Worth. He thought that he would be received as a celebrity, someone with a very interesting background, who was returning to Fort Worth, and he would publish his historic diary, and he would get a good job. He would his historic diary would be published, and they'd have plenty of money. So he thought he needed a certificate, which attested to his Russian ability. And my father volunteered to teach Russian at the public library. So the Texas Employment Agency somehow knew that there was this Pete Gregory fellow who taught Russian and perhaps could do something about this strange guy who had come in and, you know, wanted to be certified in Russian. So Lee showed up at my father's office in the Continental Life building, and my father was duly impressed with his Russian language ability and wrote him to whom it may concern letter, and invited Lee to lunch at the Texas Hotel, which was the venue of JFK's last night. And they ate lunch there, and he was sort of probing politely. He couldn't quite figure this guy out. And Lee, upon leaving, said, "Well, here's the number of my brother. We're staying there. If you want to, why don't you come by?" And shortly thereafter, my father decided he'd go over and took me with him. And that's when we met Lee and Marina at Robert's house.
So everybody basically comes away with a negative impression of Lee Harvey Oswald, who meets him. And from what I understand, you do as well.
Well, to tell the truth, there was no immediate dislike of him. There was no, you know, immediate cocky behavior to "who are you" type attitude that one could get out of Oswald. And Marina was this object of interest. We went over there because he had a Russian wife, and I was curious about what it was like to live behind the Iron Curtain. My father was curious. So Lee was kind of an appendage that you had to deal with. But he, you know, the first meeting, he didn't evoke a negative impression on me. But we talked about routine things and looked at their picture books and things like that. So to me, he was more a neutral figure, but there was always a question, was he my friend or not? And I would say that's a very hard question to answer. So I've been sort of dodging that for a while. But according to some definitions, he and I were friends. Marina and I became friends, I'm convinced. But Lee was a cipher. He said he spoke very little. He spoke very little about himself. He definitely did not want to talk about matters that were uncomfortable for him. So I really don't know how to answer your question.
I understand. So, by the way, you see him fairly routinely, regularly for a while. Other than curiosity about what was going on behind the Iron Curtain, did you have ideas of a research project or writing something about them? Or was it, like, what was your motivation? I mean, after meeting with them once, you size them up and some people would move on. Why did you continue to see them?
It was, I was studying very seriously Russian. And in those days, the days of the Iron Curtain, there simply weren't people fresh from the Soviet Union. So that was a big attraction of Marina. She could explain what life was like, what it was like to work in the pharmacy where she worked, their friends, what they did for holidays and things like that. So the formal idea was that I would go over 2-3 times a week to their house and speak Russian with Marina. I was doing a term paper at the time, which I would have had trouble handling on my own. It required a very sophisticated knowledge of Russian. So Marina and I would work a little bit on that project. I'd say the most important thing in your question was, did I see them once or twice, or did I see them regularly? And the answer is, for that period of time, June through September, mid-September, I saw a great deal of them, which makes me a rather unusual observer, because a lot of people crossed Lee's path, but it would often be at a party or some passing thing. So I would imagine I spent as much or more time with Lee and Marina than just about anybody.
Was she beautiful? Was she like extraordinarily good looking?
Yes. But one has to consider the fact that she wore, when I was with them, she wore what I'd call frumpy Soviet outfits, very little makeup. She, when made up and dressed in her favorite red dress that she brought with her from Russia, with jewels, jewelry, etc., she was quite stunning. But she also had the natural beauty of an attractive young Russian woman. She did not smile, and I did not know that she did not smile because she had bad teeth, which is characteristic of most survivors of Soviet dentistry. So that was remarkable in that there would never be any kind of a smile out of her, and the reason was the rotten teeth.
Her looks, her presence. Do you think that was like, how do I say this? Was Marina out of Lee Harvey Oswald's league in terms of looks, in terms of stature, in terms of education? And did that bring on any trouble in the marriage?
I think it did. And I have an anecdote or two about that. I think Lee, just generally speaking, Lee Harvey Oswald considered himself a unique and very talented and very brilliant person. The fact that the world did not share the same view troubled him. Marina was a registered pharmacist, which in the U.S. is a pretty impressive job. But in the Soviet Union, this would be what they called higher middle education. So she was not unique in terms of education, but she clearly was better educated than Lee, who did not complete high school, who read voraciously, but who had dyslexia and could not spell. And if, for example, Lee had to fill out a form, he would a simple form, like for Social Security or something, he would take 10 copies, because it took him 10 copies to get it right with all the misspelling that he did. So, clearly this background would have made him very sensitive to questions. Did Marina marry below what she should have expected? So, there's one anecdote where I took her, because I knew she was a pharmacist. So we went to a Fort Worth pharmacy and went to the back and talked to the pharmacist, who was not occupied. He was curious about her and asked, where is she from and so forth. And I said, she's from the Soviet Union. She's a pharmacist. He said, well, if once she learns English, send her to me. Maybe I can arrange a job for her. We told Lee about this, he who was in another part of the pharmacy, and he was quite upset by this, although I may have not captured how upset he was, because he was earning 125 an hour, and here his wife might get a job that paid normal wages. So I think that relates to your question.
Sure. No, absolutely. Hey, there are two things you mentioned briefly in the book. Number one, that she had an affair early in her marriage. And I'm curious what that was all about. Did it happen in Russia? Did it happen in America? What's the significance or lack thereof? And also, well, no, I guess I'll leave it at that. Like, number one, can you tell us about that? And how did you find that out?
I have no firsthand knowledge of Lee and Marina's sex life, other than the fact that in my presence, there was never any display of affection. There was the display of affection for the daughter June, but never any expression of affection. So everything I know on this issue comes from the magnificent book of Priscilla Macmillan, who, after the assassination, more or less lived with Marina while she was writing her book, which is called Marina and Lee. So she did gain Marina's confidence to such a degree that Marina confided in her about sexual matters. And according to what she told Priscilla, what she told Priscilla was that after marrying Lee, she sort of had second thoughts whether she'd done the right thing. So she arranged a liaison with a former boyfriend, and it happened when Lee was in Moscow trying to get a return visa. So that's what I know, and that's what I put in the book. I do not believe that Lee ever got wind of this.
That's a book worth checking out. I've heard about it, never actually sat down and read it. She's dead, I think, Priscilla Macmillan.
Recently, I think age 92 or so. She, by the way, was the one who really encouraged me to write my book. Because she had concluded that I knew as much about this as anyone and really needed to get it on record.
So before we go into the mechanics around November 22nd, what is the big, so with that in mind, what do you know? What is the, how can you explain what you know that no one else seems to know? What is your understanding about Lee Harvey Oswald that's been lacking from the public discussion or the scholarship that exists right now?
That's a tough question. I would say the unique feature of my book, and the closest parallel to this would be Priscilla Macmillan's book, which was published back in 1964, is that I'm not focusing on bullets and distance from the window to the street and whether somebody botched the autopsy, all these details which have led to innumerable conspiracy theories. My approach, very simply, is who was this guy? And was he capable and likely, if given the opportunity, to carry out what I call a low-tech assassination, just order a rifle and a pistol. And so I'm really focusing on him and Marina and their marriage. And surprisingly, there's a lot I learned from reading and working on his mother. I think you understand Lee a lot better when you hear about the exploits of the mother. So the book really boils down to a few questions, which is, did he have the means to carry out an assassination? Did he have the intelligence to carry out an assassination? Did he have the motive? Was he a natural killer? And on the last point, let's remember that he barely missed assassinating General Edwin Walker, who was a leading right-wing figure in Dallas in those days. He, without hesitation, killed Officer Tippit. He tried to kill the officer who corralled him in the movie theater. And then Robert testifies about some of the violent things Lee did as a teenager. So if you look at all, and by the way, in terms of means, financial means, one of the things that the Warren Commission found useful in their discussions with me was how they spent their money. Lee was moving to New Orleans. He even rented a storefront. He then visited Mexico City. So that sounds pretty impressive for someone who makes 125 an hour, but he spent no money. And if you don't spend anything, 125 an hour can add up. So I guess the answer to your question is, what's new is this is really a portrait of Lee Harvey Oswald and his marriage. And I think that's the key to the whole thing.
So let me ask you this, the personal toll this took on you, and let me offer you something. I don't think I've said this out loud before, but I was like 9 years old, maybe a little bit older, and I was watching a documentary about the Kennedys and the assassination. And I remember it was mostly about the Kennedy family and their how glamorous they were and sophisticated and wealthy and this and that. And at one point, I stopped kind of listening, and then they start talking about this other character, and he had been a Marine, but he didn't make friends very easily, and he was a bit of a loner. And for a split second, I thought they were talking about Kennedy, not Oswald. And I thought, wow, this guy sound I can relate to this guy. And he's at the time I was nine. I was a bit shy. I was a loner. I didn't have a lot of friends. And then I figured out, oh gosh, they're talking about the bad guy. It stayed with me for a very long time that I somehow had this sympathy for this villain of history. And it bothered me. I mean, it was one of those things that, I like it put me in a funk. It was when you're a kid, you're anyway. In that weird way, and forgive me if I'm taking a major leap here, but I think the association that you had with Kennedy yourself sometimes brought on feelings of shame, sometimes brought on, just, and it was unfair and it was irrational. You shouldn't have felt that way, but you were a, what do they call you? A known associate of Lee Harvey Oswald. That just sounds suspicious right there. So anyway, I'll stop talking for a moment. Do you understand what I just told you about what I was feeling, and did that resonate in any way with you?
Well, when I saw Lee being brought in to the Dallas police station at 4 p.m. on November 22nd, 63, I knew immediately who it was, and at that point in time, I sort of put half of the story together. By the next day, I was in a police car headed towards Oklahoma City with the Secret Service and was listening to radio reports coming in over the police channel. And they say, we got the rifle, we know it's him. So I kind of had information that was not generally available. But by that time, say noon of November 23, I was convinced he did it, And I was convinced I knew why he did it. And I knew that he could not have been part of a conspiracy. So that's pretty quick work. In terms of whether I felt sympathy, guilt, there was small amount of guilt, because I could think of a number of occasions where if I had acted differently towards them, perhaps this all wouldn't have happened. But, you know, virtually anything that happens to you in life, you can think about things that if you'd done it differently, things would have turned out differently. I would also say I was in shock. And that shock increased when I saw Ruby kill Oswald live on TV. But at that point, because of the being in shock, I really viewed all these goings on as, you know, something that I had nothing to do with. I was just an observer. So, you know, it was an event that I saw on black and white TV. It didn't have anything to do with me. So I never really felt sorry that Lee was killed. In fact, from a logical point of view, and I'm sure I had this opinion, I felt, oh no, now we're never going to know. Now there's never going to be certainty. And I think that was a pretty good insight on my part, because we have this current doubt in the with respect to the Warren report. So that was my reaction. Well, the sympathy, it is, we're not gonna get this story right.
You said, and during your answer there, you said you knew why he did it. Can you tell us why you think he did it?
He wanted to be in the history books. He felt he deserved to be in the history books. He was underestimated by society. Society did not treat him as it should. A factor that I introduce in the book is the fact that Marina scorned Lee and his crazy ideas. And what better way to show her that she was wrong, that he, in her doubt that he was not a great figure, than to kill a president? So I think that in a nutshell, and in addition, I know, in fact, I can't really remember the testimony of the psychiatrist, but clearly he had mental issues. Megalomania, who knows what else. So I never had any problem identifying, at least to my satisfaction, his motives.
What do you think would have happened to him had he not taken that shot? Had he not had Kennedy not come to town that day? Had that not happened, what would have become of Lee Harvey Oswald?
He would have, the answer to that's fairly simple, because he was already preparing for the next stage of his life, which would have been, he goes to Cuba. He is well received in Cuba because of his work in New Orleans for the Fair Cuba Committee. And that work in New Orleans was simply to give him credentials to get a Cuban visa. So had Kennedy not come to town, or had he gotten a visa, that was, I think, 2-3 months or maybe even less, but before the assassination, he would have been in Cuba, and he couldn't have killed Kennedy from Cuba. He would have gone with or without his family. So that's pretty easy to predict. Some readers have suggested to me, well, he would be a shooter at a school. You know, you can get attention that way. So, you know, perhaps he would have done something like that. But if it would have been a in the headlines for a day or two, and then he would have disappeared from view. But the answer to your question is, he gave the U.S. a couple of years. He gave the Soviet Union 3 years. He would have given Cuba a couple of years, and then he would have tried to figure out the next stage, where he would finally end up somewhere where they appreciated his wisdom and knowledge.
I think it's Norman Mailer, Oswald's ghost. He corrects for all of his limitations, Oswald's limitations. Like, you know, he updates his letters. Had they been written grammatically correct? Had they been this? Had they been that? He basically corrects for his lack of education. And I think he basically says he's a pretty sharp guy, and he's, you know, a creative, interesting young man. Number one, what do you think of that assessment?
I agree with it 100%. One problem is we tend to grossly underestimate Oswald. He did pretty well on IQ tests. He was, I think, average or above average on IQ tests. He had the burden of dyslexia, which, you know, affected his relationship with me. For you almost have to read the book to get that story. He was very cunning. He was manipulative. He knew how to plan. He planned for 3 weeks the attempted assassination of Edwin Walker. You know, he had all the bus schedules. He had what time of day Walker would be at home, would be in his study where he could get a good shot off at him. So Mailer's 100% right. That is, we underestimate him. Perhaps Mailer overestimates him, but I think that's and the fact that he is underestimated has created enormous problems, because that is the foundation of the of most of the conspiracy theories, which say a guy like that couldn't have done it by himself. But they do not understand that he has a lot of talents. And among his greatest assets was persistence. You know, the things he pulled off on 125 an hour is amazing. So I agree with Mailer on this.
Yeah, I mean, look, he defects to Russia, defects to the Soviet Union, and then comes back. I mean, both of those things are incredibly difficult to do, and it's kind of fascinating. So it's let me just ask you this. Do you think there's any possibility that this fervor of his could have been deflected, could have been harnessed in some positive way? You know, it reminds me a little bit of a guy I knew in the Marine Corps who I did not particularly like when I was on active duty, and he was kind of a pseudo-intellectual, and he wanted to be more than he was. And he was interested in Japanese stuff and Spanish stuff. And anyway, mm-hmm. I met him about 12 years later, and he had become all of those things. He had actually mastered all of those things he wanted to master. He looked like an idiot early on, but later he just was such a gentleman, and so he had become so sophisticated and accomplished. And I think he got himself a master's degree and all these other interesting things. And, but there's no, you don't see that, that would not have happened for Lee. He was so committed. He was going to go to Cuba, and he was on a roll, and it wasn't going to stop.
Well, let me say that, there was one area where I grossly misjudged Lee. And I thought he was a leftist, Marxist, communist to attract attention, that it wasn't really deeply felt that, you know, nobody likes me. I'm on the back row. Nobody knows me, but I'm special. I'm a Marxist. I've read Marx since age 15. So I thought he was a poser. He and I never really discussed any economics of Marxism or what have you. But the Warren Commission does include in its documentation two or three essays he wrote. And if you abstract from the spelling issues, clearly he had spent time trying to read this obtuse Marxist literature, but he was serious about it, and I thought he was just using it as a pose. So in that regard, I admit to being wrong.
Okay. By the way, in the Warren Commission, it documents all the places where he lived. Well, actually, do me a favor. Let's talk first about his mother. You mentioned the mother. She comes up throughout the book. The mother seems like a bit of a lunatic, and if he had any other mother in the world, I don't think we'd be talking about him today. Tell us a little bit about her and her role in all of this, if you don't mind.
Well, Lee was one of three sons. Robert and he are natural brothers, or were natural brothers. He and the other brother were half-brothers. The two other brothers were fortunate in that Marguerite farmed them out to orphanages and foster homes. So they grew up pretty much independently of Marguerite. Marguerite would regularly change jobs because she would get into fights, and she was convinced the world was against her and owed her all kinds of things. And she went from city to city, including Bronx and New Orleans and Fort Worth and so on. And so Lee was trailing along with her. And he was a latchkey kid in Bronx. But he was ingrained with her notion that they were little people. The world was against them. The world owed them something. And that they needed to fight to get what they really deserved. So she did instill in him this persistence, having a goal and going after it no matter what. So she, and by the way, I think one reason Lee enlisted in the Marines, I think even underage, was to get away from her. Once they returned, he would not allow Marina to have any dealings with her, would not allow Marina to admit her to their duplex on Mercedes Street. So, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think Lee recognized that there was much of a Marguerite in him who he hated. So who knows what consequences that had. When the assassination occurred, and this is where my father is an important eyewitness, because he was with Marina in the 4, 5, 6 days following the assassination. She either was totally crazy before the assassination, or the assassination drove her to insanity, because she was doing all kinds of ridiculous things at the Six Flags Inn where they were hiding out. So, you know, my son is innocent. No, my son is actually a CIA agent. My son deserves to be buried in Arlington National. Here she was coming out with all these bizarre things when, as the Secret Service is trying to figure out whether there was a conspiracy or not. So she was just a big pain. And fortunately for Marina, they used this opportunity to make sure that Marina would be kept distant from Marguerite. And once Marguerite left the Six Flags Inn, Marina and her children never again saw Marguerite.
Your father saw so much of this. When did your father is no longer with us, I take it.
That's true.
When did he die?
1982.
And you talked with him at length about these matters?
Yes.
The two of you are in agreement about the role of Lee Harvey Oswald in the assassination and who these characters are?
Well, I got all the facts from my father, whether we came to a mutual evaluation, you know, of what this all means. I think my father never had any problem accepting the fact that Lee did it and did it alone. He clearly understood Marguerite. He clearly understood. Let me just summarize by saying he and I would have no divergence of opinion on anything I've said today.
You mentioned briefly experiencing guilt. Did anybody ever say anything to you, make a comment to you, and you know, something disparaging, something like, yeah, you were in cahoots, or you know, associating with an assassin, what's wrong with you? Did you ever hear anyone mutter that, or did you receive anonymous letters like that?
No, this is one reason why we tried to keep our involvement unknown. So I would say most of my father's friends had no knowledge of this. Only a few of my friends had knowledge of this. And one reason, really, there are maybe two or three reasons why we wanted to keep it quiet. It would have been bad for my father's business. We understood that if conspiracy theories started floating around, one of them would be oil interests get Kennedy. Mm. And here my father was in the oil business and, you know, around influential oil people. So, you know, that would have happened. And in fact, there was a writer for the Fort Worth Post, which is now defunct, who would periodically call my father and tell him, you know, come clean. We know you and LBJ did it, and, you know, things like that. So no one came to me directly, but my father did get some of this. So mainly it didn't happen to me because, you know, very few people knew about this. And this is not something I wanted to talk about. In fact, I'm just now getting accustomed to publicly talking about these things.
You're in the book, you mentioned that the Russians panic after the assassination, and they were the ones who put the disinformation out there that the mob did it, which I thought was fascinating. Maybe people knew this. I certainly didn't. But the whole idea that the mob killed Kennedy, the Russians had a hand in pushing that notion?
Well, you know, you asked at the very beginning about my academic credentials. One of them is I've worked for many, many years with Soviet documents. And so I was in a very good position to evaluate the Oswald file, which explains exactly the Kremlin's reaction, the formal reaction, the informal reaction. The Kremlin understood that if word gets out, or if the public is convinced that Oswald did it, they would be damned, because Oswald had deserted to the Kremlin as a communist, that he had lived there 3 years, and thus by association, the Kremlin would be accused of involvement in some way. In fact, there was concern that there would be a coup in the U.S. From the military, which would then attack the Soviet Union for revenge. So for them, it was very serious stuff. They did, therefore, do their best, and starting almost from day one, to divert blame from Oswald, because Oswald was a weak point in their argument, as I just said. So they said they d decided they have to somehow deflect the blame from Oswald, and make it a product of the right wing, say, General Walker's people. Now, in so doing, they set forces, they unleashed forces to make this argument. And this affected us insofar as one of the arguments, which was, I think, put forward by the American Communist Party, was that my father had deliberately mistranslated what Marina was testifying to. That Marina said that the rifle was not Lee's, and that my father then distorted this, and that morphed into a White Russian conspiracy of which I was supposedly a participant. So, you know, even though we were trying to avoid it, and I think we kind of understood that there were going to be all kinds of wacky theories out there. This is a concrete manifestation of that.
If you called up Marina today, and she's alive, she lives east of Dallas. I mean, you were friendly to her, you were good to her. This book exists. First of all, you haven't done that. You haven't talked to her since before the assassination, correct?
Correct.
Would you ever be te were you ever tempted to do that in writing this book? And also, number one, and number two, what do you think she'd say? How do you think she'd treat you?
She's been through a lot. I recognize that fact, and I'd heard from others, in particular from Priscilla McMillan, that Marina had remarried and the husband had taken it upon himself to protect her from inquiries, outside forces, etc. I did make an effort to talk to him, and I, you know, explained the relationship, but he would not budge on that. And the minute I saw that, I didn't want to pester them.
You called him on the phone?
And to tell the truth, I was quite sympathetic to his reasons for keeping her isolated, because you know, there were, just think of all the conspiracy theorists out there, all the people who want to photograph her, etc., or send her nasty messages or what have you. You know, the right thing to do was just make no exceptions and just keep her isolated. If I were to talk to her, my guess is that my memories of those days would be much more vivid than hers, because you know, she's lived 10 lives, you know, with going through all this stuff. But no, I decided no, I'm not going to try to. Now, she did, the publisher of the book did send her a note, and give her a chance to read it and comment, and she wrote back, you know, this is all behind me. I don't want to get into this. So that's the answer to your question.
I understand. You know, it's kind of amazing. Her daughters, June and Rachel, are out there somewhere. My understanding is they've changed their names, like their first names as well. They're utterly untraceable, unfindable. Although, with that in mind, I think it was in the mid 90s, maybe early 2000s, one of them did an interview. apparently she,
yeah, it was June, I think. And no, she, it could have been Rachel, I don't know.
Yeah, one of them. And I think like she's like a hedge fund manager. I mean, like very successful in a real world, no kidding, you know, big time job. Do you know anything about them?
No.
Let me just ask you this. Did in your conversations with Marina and Lee, did you ever get the sense of whether or not they were believers in God?
The only thing I know is Lee would definitely not be. Marina, I know, was baptized as an infant by her grandmother in what was then Leningrad, now Petersburg. That's a very common thing. That was a very common thing in the Soviet Union, where the grandmother would be a believer and insist on the baptism. This was a factor that endeared Marina to the Dallas Russian community, which was headed by someone who was quite religious and organized Russian Orthodox services. So that that was something that really attracted the Dallas Russians to Marina. Now, whether she did not wear a cross, which is very common nowadays. So I can't answer. The only thing I do know is that she was willing to relate the fact that she was baptized, and it was by her grandmother, who was clearly a believer.
George, I can't pronounce his last name.
Bucher.
No, there's another one. George Morgenschild or something?
De Morgenschild.
What's his deal? What is your take on him? Did you ever meet him, by the way?
One reason why I did not include De Morgenschild is, one, once Marina and Lee moved to Dallas, I felt I didn't really have a firsthand connection. I was wrong, because we did get together on the next Thanksgiving. De Morgenschild was quite a colorful character. I never met him. You know, he was part of this Dallas Russian community. He was a man of mystery. I believe he committed suicide after his son died. But I am not a good source of information on him. I do know that he was someone with whom Lee could talk. And who didn't scorn what Lee was saying. So and he did write a very, very poorly organized book that I read, which didn't really reveal anything that was not publicly known. But he clearly was a figure. He just fell outside of the boundaries of what I wanted to cover.
You're younger than Oswald. You're 2 years younger, I think, right?
Yes.
So
I think, yeah.
It was not your place to mentor him. I mean, he's older than you. He's been to Russia and all that stuff. He was a Marine. And I'm just wondering, I think there's a reluctance today for people. The inclination is to mind your own business. You know, you're not supposed to really get involved. I think it's prevalent today. I think it was prevalent back then. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on, gosh, if only, you know, somebody, like maybe it was this George character, maybe it was somebody else. Maybe you could say, like, you know, what is the matter with you? You know what I mean? Somebody, he didn't have a father. He didn't even have a father figure anywhere in his life. And I think people are reluctant to get involved. Gosh, if only someone could have said, cut it out. You know what I mean? Smarten up. And I just think there's a reluctance to do that. What are your thoughts on that, please?
Well, this definitely would not have been my role.
No, absolutely not. That's why I point out, you're younger. You can't be, No,
younger, and he would have said, this is a spoiled kid. You know, I've been in the Marines. I've lived in Soviet Union. I've mastered the Russian language. I'm a great Marxist theorist. And what, here's this 21-year-old kid, pestering me.
No, sir. That's what I'm talking about culturally. Culturally, we stay in our own lanes. We don't do it. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about an older person, either at his work, you know, or somebody. And I think, look, you hear this about his life. He was lonely. Like, that's kind of, he was a loner and he was lonely. And nobody would penetrate that. I guess it's totally understandable given the rules of our society then and now.
No, I agree with what you're saying. And, you know, perhaps it would have made a difference. Perhaps if he had gotten closer to De Morgenschild, you know, that could have made a difference. He would not have been able to get close to my father, you know, whom I believe he respected, because my father was a very polite person. He didn't see any reason to poke his nose into someone else's business. So whatever he had conversation with Oswald, it was very cautious, you know, and avoided things that would set Oswald off. So that person did not exist. You know, the only likely one would have been his brother Robert, who was almost a saint throughout all this business.
That's right. Gosh.
That's if it had come at all, it would have come through Robert.
And I think he tried. He tried, and he really did try. Can you just share with me you met Robert, of course, right?
Of course, yeah.
And what was he like?
Successful. I think he was also a Marine, and Lee followed in his footsteps. Out of the Marines, he worked for Acme Brick Company and had risen to a relatively high level management position. He was well liked, a very devout Lutheran, and which played a role in the story, in that he did insist on a proper burial for his brother. So it's hard to find anything negative to say about Robert, but if anyone suffered through this, it would have been Robert, because he could not remain out of the limelight.
Well, what a guy. He is so thorough, right? I mean, he is so precise the way he speaks. I'm always kind of nervous around those guys and they're so just precise and skilled, and I like him a lot, by the way. Anyway, let's check out his book, okay? The Oswalds, An Untold Account of Marina and Lee. And also, many thanks to our sponsor, IronwoodGourmet.com. It's a great, great Christmas gift this year. A great acacia wood cutting board. Solid. I mean, when you give somebody a cutting board as a gift, it's substantial. You know, it's real. And everybody can use one of these things. And if they can't, they can give it to somebody who can, right? Let's face it, everybody re-gifts sooner or later. So I really like these people. I like what they do, and I love their product. IronwoodGourmet.com. That's Ironwood Gourmet. Iron, you know how to spell it. Wood, of course, gourmet, GOURMET.com. IronwoodGourmet.com. We thank you, and we thank you wherever you are listening. Many thanks. Bye-bye.